Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of Elixir Mix. And this week, it's not a panelist episode, it's a guest episode again. And we have on the button, I'm going to start with a panel. So we have on the panel today, Alan Weimar.
Hello, how's it going?
It's going good, Alan. Thank you for asking. I guess I'm also to our listeners. And here, I'm Sasha Wolf. And we have a special guest this week, like special in two ways, to be honest. Mika Kalathia. And Mika is actually somebody who used to be a panelist on the show. So before my time, to be honest. So it's nice to meet you, like a remembrance from the past. But why don't you still tell people like why you're on the show and why we are excited to have you?
Hey everyone, my name is Mika. I am on the show because I actually wrote a blog post about composing Ecto queries, and I really am a fan of making your code nice and succinct, and making sure that you can reuse your code as much as possible, so you have to write less of it. And that's what I'm here today to talk about.
Nice.
Hey folks, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs, and lately I've been working on actually building out Top End Devs. If you're interested, you can go to topenddevs.com/podcast, and you can actually hear a little bit more about my story, about why I'm doing what I'm doing with Top End Devs, why I changed it from devchat.tv to Top End Devs. But what I really want to get into is that I have decided that I'm going to build the platform that I always wished I had with devchat.tv. And I renamed it to Top End Devs because I want to give you the resources that are going to help you to build the career that you want, right? So whether you want to be an influencer in tech, whether you want to go and just max out your salary and then go live a lifestyle with your family, your friends, or just traveling the world or whatever, I want to give you the resources that are going to help you do that. We're going to have career and leadership resources in there, and we're going to be giving you content on a regular basis to help you level up and max out your career. So go check it out at topenddevs.com. If you sign up before my birthday, that's December 14th. If you sign up before my birthday, you can get 50% off the lifetime of your subscription. Once again, that's topenddevs.com.
And I already admitted before we started the recording that I got swamped at work and didn't have time to read the blog post before, but Alan did. So I guess Alan is like the nice informed person and I'm the naive one which asks all the dumb questions.
So the article is pretty good. Like, you had some pretty interesting ideas. As we talked before the show, I don't know if I agree putting all the stuff into the module folder, the module itself, but either case, like, it was still like, let's remove, like, basically I got from the gist is like, let's remove Ecto querying from the context, like the public context module, and then let's try to compose them as much as possible, right? And I think it's pretty interesting. It's kind of, it's almost like a mini DSL you have going on with the way you did all the functions, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's kind of what the end goal is to really build yourself a DSL that you can use in your library to set, well, really to create yourself a library. So once you have a library that has a DSL for you, you just have to stop remaking functions, then dropping into like basically pure Ecto and hitting the Ecto query API, and you can instead just call your own functions and compose them together. So as long as you built yourself a composable enough library, you can essentially stay out of actually writing any Ecto query functions at all and just call your library over and over again, composing the functions that you've already created. So you can reuse what you've done in previous work and just continue to reuse that for forever, really.
Yeah, that could work for like simple cases, but once you start having like window functions and all kinds of like specialized queries, then how would you handle something like that though? I mean, would you just make a separate function within the struct module, or how would you handle something like that?
Yeah, something like that I would handle by exactly as you said, just making a query function again inside of the schema. So you could, as you were saying, I know you mentioned that you didn't really like how the schema was holding all the queries. I think it's really just so about splitting that responsibility between context and schema, and or really just context and the query spot that you're going to store all the queries. So you're not calling your queries inside your context. That could be any file. But yeah, again, I would just store that excess code or that unique case query inside of that schema. And that way you can kind of isolate it off again as its own query, and you can call it as needed. So you might not ever call it again, but it's isolated. You can kind of, that's where it lives, and you know where to find it now, because you can go and you can look for queries related to the user, for example, and you'll just find that user window function in there. So you know where to go to find your queries as well. It not only creates a reusable pattern, it creates an easy way to find what you're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I said before we actually did the recording, is the nice thing about Elixir and the nice thing about how Ecto queries work, all of these are pure functions, right? So if at some point you realize, okay, for example, the user module gets too big, because there's a lot of validation maybe also going on in change sets, and there are multiple ways we want to compose queries. You could easily move that into a module of its own, right? You could say, okay, now I'm going to create a user queries model or even multiple queries model if you have distinct use cases where you might want to use those. So nothing is stopping you from splitting that up into multiple distinct parts, and then composing them back together, which is like a very, very nice quality of pure functions, which we have here. So, I mean, why not start in the schema module and keep it simple? Then at least you know where to go at first and move it later out later when it gets complex.
Yeah, it's often...
So this is only for querying, right? Sorry, I was just thinking about this. Is only for querying, right?
Yeah, it's really only for querying. You can do it for update or delete, like if you're using an update all function. You could also do it for delete using like delete all. So you can use it for really any of the query functions that you can pass in just a raw query. Obviously, insert's not going to work, but...
So why is it that you think that we should remove the queries from the context function? I mean, when you generate like with a scaffold, all this stuff, you get that original style. Why is it you think that it should not be in there?
I'd say that when you get to a really large project, it makes it very difficult to work with the context when there's a lot of queries in them. It often means that you're either having to break apart the context too early because there's just tons of query code in there, or the context just gets out of control and you have like a 500 or 600 line context. Whereas if you can move those queries into another place, then it gives you a way of organizing them that's more manageable in a larger project. So like the project I work on for work has tons of schemas. We probably have over 100 schemas. And having 100 schemas comes with having multiple contexts. So we probably have around 20 contexts for those 100 schemas. But each of those contexts is really lightweight and has under 100 files. Sorry. It's all the early morning telemarketers. That's what it is. I just get random spam calls in the morning from telemarketers. It's great.
Way to be stopped.
I'm kind of lost there too.
So
why not in context? Why not in context? Why move it into a different place?
You left off that you have a very large project and it makes
over 100 schemas.
To split things up.
Maybe repeat that sentence and then we can edit it out. And then.
Yeah. So we basically have over 100 schemas at work, and with a lot of schemas come a lot of context as well. And so we have around 20 contexts, and I can't imagine what it would look like if we had actually put the queries in those contexts as well. There's tons of custom queries that go on, and a lot of the queries are actually just like fragments under the hood. So they're just calling out to a fragment. And if you had that in the context directly, we'd probably have double, if not more, contexts than we do already. And we'd also lose the ability to reuse the functions very easily, or else the reusability would just look a bit weird because you're calling other context modules from within a context, and you might get cyclical calls to your context, essentially.
Yes, it also, I feel like it cleans up the context because, I mean, otherwise you kind of operate on different layers of abstraction there. We had that, maybe not as big as like your 1/100 schemas, but still I used to work on a project which was relatively big. And then when I feel like contexts are usually the place where you would put some kind of business logic, right, which goes beyond validating on a basic level, which should arguably probably happen either in the change set or even before in the controller. But like the business logic, like the high level business logic, that's from my point of view, that's where you put that is the context. And then you're not really that interested into the nitty-gritty of like, okay, how do I query this particular schema now? I would just like to say, okay, for this particular piece of my business logic, I'm interested in users which compose, which fulfill these and those criteria, for example, right? What we did there was like similar to your approach, but slightly different, that we actually had like a queries module on a case-by-case basis, where we said, okay, we have particular queries we want to do, and those get composed in a module. And the functions we wrote there were like a little bit different, that we didn't have like by code or by first name or by last name. It was more, you could give it like a keyword list of different arguments, and then that basically did an enum reduce over that and composed it into one big query, which worked nicely, to be honest. But the idea is the same. The idea is exactly the same. The API is slightly different.
So that actually reminds me of EctoShorts. So it sounds very similar to what I did with EctoShorts, which is a library I also introduced at the very bottom of the blog post. And so what that is it's basically a library that does exactly what you're saying. I'll give you a few seconds to look it up, and then you can see But basically what it does is it allows you to pass that keyword list and also a query object, and then it'll filter based off of any relational field or any field, natural field of that schema. And it actually takes it one step further. You can go down one level of nesting for relational fields as well. And so you can query off of relations and you can do all sorts of filters with that as well. So you get like the I like filters and the greater than, less than, you get all of that. And I basically formed it into a parameterized API where you can essentially just give a map with a bunch of keys and it'll turn that into a query for you.
Yeah, it's quite similar to what we did. Like, I mean, the way we did the composing there was more focused, right? I mean, which you can do if it's your own code, where we said, okay, we want to focus this particular field always with like an I like, or this field always with like an equals, right?
Yep.
That was like a decision we made there on that API level. But a part of that, yeah, it was exactly that. You could say, okay, please give me the user, and then which has these properties, or this other schema. I don't think it was always a user. It's too long ago. I can't tell you specifics. But it worked out really nicely in like a use case. And at the end of the day, was a good example of also, if you drill down into how it works, relatively straightforward, right? Like an enum reduce and then a bunch of private function clauses which do pattern matching, and your air quotes just done, like nothing more.
Yeah, that's really all it is for the Ecto Shorts library as well. So it sounds like they're very similar in that way. Maybe that's just like the beauty of functional programming languages, is that you can really just reduce anything. And you can just make whatever you want out of almost a singular reduce most times, or maybe two. It's pretty impressive. I'm in the middle of a composable generator library right now. And that is also just like everything is a reduce. It's quite fascinating to see.
Yeah. Also, I do remember that I think it was one of the first cases where a reduce really felt natural. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes you can solve problems with reduce and it feels a bit awkward just in terms of like thinking about it. But like here you say, okay, I want to get out this query at the end of the day, and I have this list of arguments. So it feels very natural to use your reduce there. Okay, yeah, I was pretty happy before it turned out in the end. So I can certainly see why you ended up with extra shorts and a similar pattern. It just lends itself nicely to it.
It really does. It's a really nice pattern, especially once you start moving into like Absinthe or GraphQL or even your controllers. Just having the ability to open up a parameter and have it automatically just work is amazing. So for example, if you have your libraries all connected with Ecto Shorts and your GraphQL API just going straight through that, you can essentially just add a parameter to the argument. Like say you need a name filter, you just add the argument for name. And because the parameters are all going through Ecto Shorts, everything is all hooked up and that's all you needed to do. And now you have the ability to query by name. So it's because you have that ability to query by any natural field, and you can just hook it up to things and allow it to just work. And creating CRUD APIs is almost simple at that point because you're just hooking them up straight to a single function call.
What is this? Sorry, I'm looking at the configuration for Ecto Shorts. And of course, you got to configure a repo. And it's cool that you can also configure a replica. But the one thing I didn't quite get is the error module. Like, what is this exactly?
Yeah, I didn't
quite get it.
So the reason I allowed you to configure an error module is to customize errors. So I'm a big fan of creating error systems in your framework and allowing your system to essentially have errors that you expect. And so one of the ways that we do that is by having a specific struct that is responsible for an error. And so I actually open sourced this as well. There's a library that I have called error message. And what it is it's just literally a wrapper for errors, and that's all it does. But by wrapping errors, it allows you to have predictable errors in your system. And so you can have predictable responses and pattern match off like a code, for example. And so instead of trying to pattern match on a string, which is super frail, like someone can just come along and change that string because, oh, I didn't understand the message, I just went and typed and changed it. And who knows what resulting code broke. But if you have a consistent code, then you can keep the response matching without it being frail, without having that fragility. And so that's why I'm a really big fan of error messaging systems and having like an error system in place in your overall project, because that allows you to overall and anywhere in your project just repeatedly match and pull out these errors and try and find a specific one. Like, for example, if you had like the error message library exports functions for all of the HTTP errors. And so if you can fit your error into that, like a not found error, then anywhere in your app, you can just kind of match for a code not found. You don't have to care about the error message or what it even looks like. You just look for the code not found. And that is not going to change no matter what message may change. So to go back to why that's in Ecto Shorts, is Ecto Shorts allows you to override that. And so you can make the errors that come out of Ecto Shorts familiar to your own system. And then it looks and feels like the errors that come out of Ecto Shorts are part of your system. And that can be useful because a lot of times your middleware for formatting will take into account your error system, and it'll know how to format the errors that come out of your system. So that way, whatever you're returning, whatever errors come out, they're automatically formatted, and the same can be applied to anything that comes out of Ecto Shorts.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. It's also like a fierce, the notion is related to some wisdom in the Elixir community around not overusing the error tuple pattern, right? Like if you actually want to get some more information passed down, then I've heard a lot of people suggest to reach for structs rather and say, okay, package it up in structs which are self-explanatory and which give the same level of context to your calling APIs instead of having these deeply nested tuples you sometimes see. And I've been guilty of to do myself, to be honest.
But that would be like, so if you have an error tuple, then the second argument or the second value would definitely be the error struct, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It would still have an error tuple, but the second value would be a struct. And I've been guilty myself of like having the second argument being a tuple then again, and then having some values inside of that. And it just becomes easier to deal with if you have structs there, because then you can, for example, just match on the struct name if it's a specific error message, or it can match on a particular field of a struct name. You don't have to know this structure and the number of fields as much as if you would have a nested second level tuple, which then you would have to match on explicitly, right?
I'd say definitely. And it doesn't even have to be a struct. Like, honestly, you could just use a map or a keyword list, like just anything that allows you to store some fields in it and then pattern match. Actually, maybe I wouldn't use a keyword list, just simply because you have to match all the fields of a keyword list. Mm-hmm. So you probably would not want to do that. And maps are probably the best bet. Maps or structs, I would probably use those. I find that map structs are nice in some sense, because then you can add protocols to them. So you can add like a protocol for the inspect protocol or the enum one, and that allows you to pass it to like things like the JSON field from Phoenix, so you can use the Phoenix JSON function to render as long as the enum protocol is implemented. So stuff like that is really nice with structs, where you can just pass them straight to other libraries and have them work.
Yeah, and then if you even go down another level of, where you say, okay, I don't know, this, for example, implements the error. Is it def error then? What do you do? Def exception? I don't remember. If you do that, you could even then go ahead and say, okay, on my context level, if it bubbles up to that, I'm going to raise it. If a function has a bang, and then I could implement a handler for that on my Phoenix layer and return a specific error message. All these are things you can reach for if you have structs, and not as easily if you use anything else, basically.
Totally.
So
I think it's really cool that having these like systems in place allow you to just reuse code more. And so similar to like the Ecto, how we were talking about Ecto and being able to reuse code there, you can reuse code once you have an error system as well, because then all your errors are the same. And so you get to reuse any code that handles those errors as well. So I like the factor of reusing code. And I think that oftentimes, like, we can have a really good library or a really good small set of tools that can be reused in many different ways. And having a little Swiss Army knife is not a bad thing, as long as you don't overcomplicate it. Sometimes, like, people can overcomplicate it, and then you're stuck with a Swiss Army knife with like one of those big ones that it's like this thick, like a few inches.
System
thick.
D.
System D, is that a good case of that? I would
say, yeah, probably.
I don't have a strong opinion on the matter, so please don't flail me, but I've heard talks in that direction.
No, it's true.
A lot of what you just said is related to the Unix philosophy, right? Of having multiple small tools which are very purpose-driven and then compose them into something bigger.
Yeah, I really like that idea. I actually didn't know that was Unix philosophy, but I like it. I'm all on board with that idea.
Yeah, when you create these errors, right, you're actually like transforming every single possible error that you may consider that you may encounter, and then like wrapping it to like your own error type. I'm just like, this is kind of a newer idea. I haven't heard of something like this before in when I've been looking at code.
Yeah.
Like, so, I know, like, you know, like I understand like Postgres have an error, but then you'll probably change it to an Ecto error. But like, I haven't seen anybody do that in their own application. So maybe you can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, for sure. So what it looks like is really just wrapping errors that come out of even like foreign systems, for example. So most of the times you can, because the front end is also relying on these errors, you can wrap the errors to make sure that the air, like the errors coming out of your system are just like homogenous and all the errors are the same format essentially. And so that includes like any errors that you're getting from third parties that you might be calling. One of the downsides to that is you might not know every single error type, but that can be handled by just using like say an internal server error for ones that you don't know. And so that like the ones that you don't know, you can kind of just pass into a like a catch-all basically. Like the internal server error is really the catch-all of the error world. It's you know you can just put whatever you want in there. It's like something is just generically wrong, and so that way you can define between known errors and unknown errors as well in your system. And so when you're working with third parties, you can often translate the errors that come back from third parties into errors from your system, whereas the other ones that you don't know how to handle, you can just leave as an internal server error. And that allows your front end to also plan around that too, so you know the errors, you're thinking about them up front, and that allows you to tell and communicate to the front end, hey, these are the errors I think you might possibly get. You might need to create handlers for this. This can be really useful. I've personally used it most recently when developing integrations with Stripe, because Stripe has a ton of different types of errors, and most of them we can handle. But however, there's just like a few that come up that we're not really sure. They happen at weird times. And that's where the internal server errors have been great, because they give us a pre-warning, like something happens and the front end can render it, but they also triggers a message for them saying, hey, we had an internal server error with this, and now we have a log saying there's something wrong. This internal server error shouldn't have happened. Maybe it should happen, and we know the parameters now, and we can add it to the list of known errors. But in general, we shouldn't be having these internal server errors pop up. And when we do, that's a sign to look into it deeper, essentially. And maybe the ones that we return internally are more okay to be seeing because they're not actual errors, or else they're just like if they're not actual errors, they're like a error for not being found or something. You call the database and it didn't find the record. So you have a not found error popping up.
So I'm just trying to think, like, as you're sprinkling this code, like throughout, like, I'm just trying to think, what does that even look like? Because like, if you're, let's just say you're calling repo, you know, repo.all everywhere. And let's say there's some error that happens, like, or maybe a better one would be like, if you do like an insert, right? And it's not actually valid according to the database rules, you're going to get an exception.
Yeah.
Like, how would I, like, let's say I want to handle that. I want to wrap it with a very custom error because I want to handle that for whatever reason, right? Like, and if I have this in multiple places throughout my app, like, how would I do the wrapping? Like, what, should I just have like a translate function that just takes like, okay, so if it's okay, then just return the original value. If it's not okay, then transform it to this. Like, I'm just trying to understand like what the code actually looked like if I have this kind of, you know, error sprinkled throughout my system.
Yeah, a lot of times it just looks like you calling the function of the module in the function. So error message dot not found, and then you pass in the message. The second parameter is basically just a details parameter, which you can pass anything into, and it'll just put it on the details parameter of that struct. And so that is where you can just basically pass down the error that you already had if there's relevant information on there, so that you can provide all the details that came with that error, but then still have that custom message. And what that allows you to also do is basically, because you have that custom error message, you can now just render that error. And no matter where the errors are coming from in your system, they're all the same. So you can just pass them right into that JSON rendering function from Phoenix and just have them render out because it's following that error message struct. And so you know and can utilize that error message struct. It doesn't matter where the errors are coming from or what they are, but because it's wrapped, they'll just show up to the front end. And that can, basically, it means that there's no holes in your error system. And so anything that happens in your actual backend, even if it's an error you don't expect, will end up with a real error message to the front end that you can actually use to go back and debug. It can also shoot you in the foot, actually, because if you're doing something like authentication and you try and put things on the details that are for developers, like say the tokens or something, and they come back as errors to the front end, that might not be so good. So you kind of have to watch yourself for sensitive information going to the front end.
Yeah, but that's basically always the story, right? I mean, that you have to look at, okay, where do you put sensitive information? And I mean, from a code organization level, that would, from my experience, I've done similar things, not in the sense of like having this error wrapping, but in the sense of like translating errors from like an external source, for example. And that, how I usually tackle that is like, I have a very well encapsulated high level module where I say, okay, these are the use cases I would like to communicate with this external system, for example. Then this on that module, or like modules beneath, that takes care of the nitty-gritty stuff of communicating, right? And then this takes care of also capturing potential errors, translating basically known errors, so to speak. I mean, there's like this distinction between all the things you expect to go wrong and then the things which unexpectedly go wrong. So translate its known errors into a different structure, and unknown errors also into like more general. Could this something happened which I did not expect to happen, but then at least you don't leak this implementation details, so to speak, to the rest of your application, which doesn't really have to care that this, for example, is an external system you're speaking to, but rather that, okay, I have this functionality I need for this part of my application, and this module over there provides it, and however, then you have it well encapsulated and also have a nice place to translate these errors. That's how I usually do it on a code organization level.
Hi, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs, and lately I've been coaching some people on starting some podcasts and in some cases just taking their career to the next level. You know, whether you're beginner going to intermediate, intermediate going to advanced, whether you're trying to get noticed in the community or go freelance, I've been helping these folks figure out how to get in front of people, how to build relationships, and how to build their careers and max out and just go to the next level. So if you're interested in talking to me and having me help you go to the next level, go to topendevs.com/coaching. I will give you a 1-hour free session where we can figure out what you're trying to do, where you're trying to go, and figure out what the next steps are. And then from there, we can figure out how to get you to the place you want to go. So once again, that's topendevs.com/coaching.
That makes a lot of sense. I think the thing that changes a lot for me is just over time how people use those error systems. If you don't have like a solid foundation set up, then how people build error systems might change over time. Like some people might choose to do a slightly different style in other apps. I don't know how, so the projects that I've been working on recently at Blitz, we have basically one umbrella app, and that one umbrella app has around 40 apps inside of it. And so, as you can imagine, there can be quite a bit of drift in between apps if you don't have a solid foundational layer, because there's just like, we can't all look at every single PR, meaning we can't see if some error systems are just a tiny bit out of place or they're returning the wrong errors. And that might not fall too well in when that code, if it's like in a reusable library in one of those umbrella apps, and then we start to reuse that in another app and it just completely breaks because the errors aren't the right format, that's something we can't really catch because there's just not enough eyes on that PR. Basically, we don't all have time to look at that one PR. And so having that error system in place really just removes that chance of happening. You just don't have the ability to create errors that won't work with the rest of the system.
Wait, did you just mention that you have an umbrella app? Because we had a big discussion a couple of weeks ago about none of us really have experience with umbrella apps. And like,
that's not true. I have a lot of experience with umbrella, but we don't have a lot of experience with poncho apps, Adam.
Poncho apps are a bit.
Oh, poncho, okay.
Poncho apps are fun. I remember, I've done them a few times for mostly for nerves, but I've done them a few times for real projects as well. And they've been not as fun to maintain as just a normal umbrella app, I'd say.
Yeah, we actually made that decision on you had an episode on that. And where we discussed, okay, to umbrella or not to umbrella, that was also, I think, the title, and talked about like having one big app, right? Having umbrella apps, having poncho apps, having multiple distinct services, that are all the things we talked about. Because we had to make the decision at my current workplace, as we currently have a more service-oriented architecture, but we don't really have a need on an organizational level. Like a lot of, it's just free backend devs, so there's like no distinct separate ownership, so to speak. So we made the decision to move to one big monorepository. And also then we had made the decision on actually having one big app, not an umbrella app, but having one big app. Because umbrella apps come with their own trade-offs.
I know a lot of people talk about the trade-offs of umbrella apps. I've actually never really seen too many of the downsides. I've been using umbrella apps since I basically started with Elixir, just because I found that they're a really great way to package a lot of code. And I've never had an issue that, like, I know a lot of people talk about the issues, but I've never seen any of them yet. So I'm not sure what's going on there, or if the way that I use umbrella apps lucky just you. Falls into a lucky spectrum, but I've never had an issue with them.
Lucky you. Yeah. I don't want to reiterate on everything we talked in that episode, but so you can go back and listen to it if you want to, folks, if you don't have yet. But yeah, umbrella apps. I have experience with umbrella apps, and I'm just going to say this, like it has bitten me in a few places, mostly when it comes to configuration. So that's why umbrella apps can be sticky. But like I said, I'm not going to go into all of the details.
The config and umbrella apps, always a fun time.
So I actually would like to ask, just because I'm curious myself. So you're currently working with Blitz, right? And that means Blitz is driven by Elixir?
Yep.
Blitz GG?
Blitz GG is all driven by Elixir. We have a few Node backend services, but for the most part, everything is in Elixir.
And how is like the stuff you laid out in your blog post, and the stuff we talked about with like this for error messaging? I guess a lot of that is related to the work you do there at Blitz GG?
Yeah, so everything is in use there. I've basically been using these patterns since I started in Elixir. ActoShorts was actually the first library I ever created. And I created it originally by putting all, like it was a macro that would put all of the functions onto your schema. So you'd have like user.create.find. And Jose actually told me not to do that. I posted the library, like it was ages ago, like this was before 1.0, before Elixir 1.0. And he basically said, like, don't do this. Like, this is not the way. And so I refactored everything to take in the schemas instead as a parameter. And that's why the library looks like that now and is not like user.create, because originally I made it like Active Record, right? So I came from Ruby and I loved Active Record and I was like, okay, let me just make this for Elixir. And so I did that and it was just like, no, this isn't the right way. This isn't the Elixir way. And so ever since then, I've been using those libraries at basically every project I've ever worked on. And same with the Error one too. The Error one was my second library. And again, I've been using that ever since. And so at Blitz, we also use both of those. We have tons of schemas, as we mentioned before, and tons of contexts. And that's how we organize our code. We split the queries into the schemas and the contexts compose them all together. Most of the time, ActoShorts is related to that. And yeah, and all the errors coming out are part of the error messaging system. The error message, like we actually don't have structs at Blitz, we just use maps right now. But the intent is to move over to that error message library as well, just because it's a bit of a drop-in replacement for us, because we already follow the same format just without the struct. So all the map matching will still work for us.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Pretty cool to hear. Any other interesting stories on that front where you can say, okay, this is like a another challenge, and maybe not in the open source space, but something you learned while working on this big system? Because I think a lot of our listeners have experience with umbrella projects with like 40 different sub apps. So I feel like there could be some interesting pieces of knowledge there.
Yeah, I think like when you're working on really large apps, the way you code almost changes, and like the way you organize your code changes. Because what I've started to learn is that there's a very big distinction between like library code and internal like business logic code, or basically everything else. And that happens even with your own internal libraries too. So the way that you write your internal libraries has to look significantly different than the rest of your code, because it has to handle your own developer errors, basically. So it has to raise the proper things so that the developers will actually know what's going on. You're not just going to get random errors that are hidden within a library, basically. Like the worst thing is when you get a stack trace and none of the stack trace is part of your own code or even something that you can really reason about. You just look through libraries and you're like, I don't know what's going on here. So that in effect, when you create libraries internally, the same problem also happens, and you kind of have to manage that and maintain like a high level of really well built up stack traces so that you're not giving your developers just random gibberish errors. Other lessons that we've learned are just like, I'd say Postgres lessons. Postgres is always the issue. It's usually like the first thing that breaks. Like Elixir is almost never going to be the problem on your machine, as long as you've designed things following OTP and you're like not blocking your processes, for example. You're really just going to have a smooth time in Elixir. And the first thing that happens is you're going to start hitting like DB connection errors because something in the database went wrong. And whether that's like, oh, I forgot an index here, or whether it's like, oh, I'm just querying this thing too much, my query is wrong, it's not optimized. There's like so many problems that can happen in the database, and very few that actually happen in Elixir. And I think that's like one of the beauty of working in Elixir. One of the things I really like about taking on a large project in Elixir is just the problem is not Elixir. Like when you actually are deploying these things or have them as long-running systems, the problem is not Elixir. It's some other external service connected to Elixir. Like there's a few times where Elixir's been a problem, like message passing large messages that can become a problem, or we've created bottlenecks and needed some pools to solve them. Those are like the easy problems almost to solve at this point, because it's like we have a set of tools, we know the answer. There's a problem, it's like, okay, this process is getting hammered. You use some pools, you split them out. There's like known solutions. The database is the one thing where the solution is just, it's almost different every single time. I don't think there's ever been a situation where the solution is the same. And that's kind of one of the things that I've learned as a big piece of wisdom, is just the database. You just focus on that And if you're scaling, most of the time, the database is always going to be the issue. And you can really rely on Elixir to scale you as long as you've built out your system properly.
Yeah, cool. That sounds like a very, very, very valuable lesson. But I also feel like it's probably related to that. I mean, the database takes care of a lot of complex things for us, right? So it's probably not unexpected that that complexity is going to come back at some point and say, okay, hey, here, now you have to think a bit more about it. I mean, at the end of the day, Postgres takes care of so much for you, you don't have to think about, and it pushes you very far. So just want to like make a shout out to Postgres here.
Postgres is honestly amazing. I'd say like, when I first started using Postgres, I'd always hear people say like, oh, it doesn't scale well. Like there's a limit where you can't scale it. And I'd think that is like completely wrong. We actually replaced Cassandra in our app with Postgres. Like a lot of our Cassandra related things are now going into Postgres and it still performs just fine. We ingest like around 30 million rows a day. Maybe actually nice. Quite a bit more than that, because that's just the amount like of matches that we're getting every day. But then all the other records, I'm not counting. So basically, as we input matches, we get around 30 million of those daily. And so we use Postgres for everything. We have aggregates run on it. Like everything is built on top of Postgres. And it's very, very quick, provided that you build the right schemas and you know what you're doing. We personally had to partner with some DBAs and as consultants. And that honestly was one of the best decisions we made, because they have so much knowledge. And it's amazing the amount of things that Postgres can do, and the amount of things that we don't know about that are just not common knowledge. But DBAs are just like, hey, this is just the most common thing you would do. Like this, like when you hit this problem, here's the answer. But for us, we just hit this wall and we're like, oh, Postgres isn't scalable. Let's start up Cassandra, or like, let's start up this new database that's a bit faster.
I think one of the coolest things that people don't know is that there's actually a PubSub built into Postgres, which is really interesting. And I actually used that in a project. I got brought onto the one of the other podcasts because of the solution, because I showed it to people. It was like super popular video I created about how to actually do it. Because like the issue I had was like, my client says he wants this chat system built and he wants to be able to like delete messages. But then like when you have a reply to a message, we have like a relation, right? So a message can be like reply to another message. And so if you delete the root message, and then all those replies on there have to also be removed too. That was part of the requirements. And so like, how do we actually do this? Well, we actually like use PubSub to kind of handle this, because like, you know, you can have like a cascade effect where you just keep deleting things that are related. And so every time that a row was deleted, we would just broadcast a message saying, you know, this was deleted. And then that would actually send a message across the WebSocket to all the connected clients through a WebSocket, and that would just remove the message on their device. So it was really awesome and just worked perfectly.
And also, if you're using Commanded in your app locally, you're actually using the PubSub mechanism, because Commanded is relying on the PubSub mechanism for.
Oh, really? I had no idea, but it makes sense.
I know this because we, in this big umbrella app I mentioned earlier, that we also used Commanded. And then we migrated over to Azure, which was like a C-level decision. Let's just say that. And that was when Azure was like 5-6 years ago. So Azure was very early, I'd say. And actually, the PubSub mechanism on the managed Postgres in Azure was broken, which we figured out, because basically what happened there, that's part of our app, when they booted up, they consumed all the events which were pending until then, but they didn't consume new events. We were like, well, what's happening? What's going on? Why are they not consuming new events? And they actually got in touch with like with a guy behind Commanded. I don't remember his name right now. And he actually digged into like the managed Postgres on Azure and figured out that PubSub was broken there. So yeah, that was a fun day.
That's awesome. When your managed SQL providers are just like, are broken in a major feature. I wonder how that even happened. That's a really interesting story.
Can't tell you. I mean, it took a bit of back and forth also with the support until they also arrived at the conclusion that, yes, actually, this is broken. Okay, we're going to fix it.
That's so funny. I think Postgres is actually just so amazing and has so many powers that we don't know about. One of the things that like I often use, that we use all the time at Blitz actually, and that allows you to scale, is just like partitioning and being able to partition your data. I think not a lot of people I've seen that use Postgres actually use the partitioning feature as well. And oftentimes, like when you're setting up a database, if you plan to have high scale, you really need that partitioning in order to set up anything that scales. And having it set up from the beginning, you kind of also need that, because when you don't have it set up from beginning, well, we've personally been there at Blitz, and it's led to like, we've had to go down for hours to be able to rebuild a database, or else we're just like we have another database that we spin up on the side and then have to rebuild our new data into there, or create new tables and build them into our own database again. But sometimes there's performance loads, so you can't do that. So there's like all sorts of issues that you face that if you don't set things up properly with partitioning the first time. But I don't think I've ever seen it be used outside of something like Blitz, like a big app. And even in cases where it can be used, instead people are just like, oh, Postgres doesn't scale. So it's cool that you also have been able to use it in managed as well, and have like the PubSub system is so successful, and be able to use that at scale with something like Commanded. Like, that's pretty awesome.
I'm actually curious. I mean, now you said you haven't seen partitioning, for example, used that often, but that you feel it, more people should know about it, right? Do you have some reading you can recommend for our listeners? And also, I mean, I would look into that myself, to be honest.
I actually don't have too many sources for this. So I first learned about partitioning from the DBAs directly. And so most of my knowledge from Fair Postgres enough. Has come from like one-on-ones with the database, the DBAs, and basically just asking them like, hey, what does this do? Or what does this do? Or like, how do you do this? Or what happens when you're in this situation? So all of it has just been like firsthand knowledge of just talking to the DBAs when things have gone wrong, and basically just figuring out like why did it go wrong and what are the solutions. They have just amazing amounts of wealths of knowledge, like 20 years of knowledge. And that's just working in Postgres. And once you've started working on the core of Postgres, it seems like tons of other skills are unlocked. It's pretty amazing.
That sounds pretty neat, to be honest. But it also sounds like Postgres is kind of this Swiss Army knife with a lot of tools at its disposal.
Yeah, it's starting to seem like the Unix philosophy there, isn't it?
or rather the opposite of it.
Yeah, maybe so. It might be a bit too big for the small tools. Maybe it's just like that one mega tool. It's like a god object at this point.
Yeah, nice. Okay, anything else you'd like to let our listeners know, you'd like to promote, anything you would like to ask, Alan? Otherwise, I would probably slowly transition us to picks.
Yeah, so
no, I just want to say thank you for giving me more reading to do. Now I have to read about table partitioning because I'm running into some scalability recently. So hopefully this may solve my issues, but I got too many things to read, man.
I definitely
too much
know.
Knowledge to look up.
Well, here's another piece of knowledge for you. So I actually run an Elixir course called Learn Elixir, where we teach all of these things as well as how to scale into basically the same levels as Blitz has or higher. And so that's what I've been working on recently. I've actually been working on the course for about 2 years now. So it's only something I've been public with recently. Like when I was on the panel in the past, I never mentioned it at all because I didn't think it was ready yet. Like I wasn't confident that we'd have the ability to teach what I wanted to or wasn't right. But we've had tons of people come through the course now, and we've seen really good results. People are loving it. They're learning. They're getting jobs out of it just due to the fact that their Elixir's knowledge after the course has been really good. Like they know the core fundamentals well enough that you can basically be successful in any type of job that you have because you just know the core. And I think that's one of the really cool things about OTP that's not talked about very much is once you know the core fundamental underlying principles, how do schedulers work? How do processes work? You can really work in any project and be successful.
I feel like that could also be valuable to a lot of people out there because recently Alan and me did an episode on like OTP in depth and realized that there is not a lot of good resources out there to learn these pieces of wisdom. Like, okay, how do you really properly build out an OTP system, and what are some things you maybe don't want to do, and what are some implications if you do them, and all these kind of things. And I did absorb them by osmosis, to be honest, from like colleagues who were more experienced than working alongside them, and I'm asking them questions when certain issues popped up and see how they solve them, right? But there was not a single source I could point to learn all of that. So I can certainly see that this kind of knowledge and this kind of course can fill a gap in the education experience in Elixir.
Definitely agree with you there. That's why I created the course. I just found that there wasn't one succinct source to learn everything about Elixir from. So the course has 132 videos, each of them ranging from 10 minutes to 20 minutes long. The earlier ones in the course are a bit longer. Some of them are like 30 to 40 minutes, but there's tons of content in there. And it really does get you from like, I don't know Elixir, but I know how to program, to like, I know how to scale a program with Elixir. Build a scalable architecture. So,
okay, folks, then let us go to picks, I guess. Oh, wait, one last thing. If people want to get in touch with you, Mika, how do they do that?
Yeah, so if you ever want to get in touch with me or ping me for some advice, I'm always available on the Elixir Slack. I'm pretty much open in there all the time. So the Elixir course that I run, we have a private Slack channel in there. And so all of my students are in that Slack as well, which means that by default, I'm always available in that Slack. So if you ever want to ping me or have some questions, feel free to. I may not respond right away, but I will try and respond as quick as I can.
Nice. Okay, then this time. Third time is a charm, right? Let's go to picks.
Hey, folks, if you love this podcast and would like to support the show, or if you wish you could listen without the sponsorship messages, then you're in luck. We're setting up new premium podcast feeds where you can get all of the episodes released after Christmas 2020 without the ads. Signing up will help us pay for editing and production, and you can go sign up at devchat.tv/premium.
Alan, why don't you shoot us off with a new Rust book?
Yeah, sorry. So as I mentioned before, because I hurt my fingers, right? I've been not really digging too much into Rust these days or even any kind of the programming stuff. But I did happen to get a new toy. So it's called the Elgato Stream Deck. So because I hurt my hand, I've been trying to find ways to kind of shortcut using my fingers, right? So I set up like a couple of buttons on here that I could just press with my left hand, which is my worst hand. And so like I have a button over here related like dictation. I press it and I can use Siri to type out what I need to type with my voice. So it's been super helpful. I also can control my lights with this one too. So super useful.
He's turning off his lights in his background just to prove a point.
That's awesome.
Also my spotlight. Yeah. So yeah, I think this is a super awesome thing. So I think that, you know, if you're interested in kind of doing some more kind of automation stuff, it's pretty cool. Check it out. So that's my pick.
Okay, nice. I'm going to pick two things this week. One is completely personal and the other is more technical. Wait, let me sort up my note. Okay, so let me start off with a fun one. The fun one, personal one, is I've recently started playing Dyson Sphere program. And it's basically science fiction 3D Factorio. And you build a Dyson Sphere. And if you don't know what a Dyson Sphere is, it's like you basically encase a star into an artificial structure to harness all of its energy. And that is just insanely cool, if you ask me. What you need to do there, like, is you have to set up this completely automated logistics system building the different parts of a Dyson Sphere to like pump and to pump out all the parts and like make it automated and all that kind of stuff. And it's scratching that part of my brain, which is like related to analytic thinking and also programming. And that's something I've been doing less at my day job. So I feel it's kind of nice to have this also in this like low pressure environment where you can just play around and delete stuff and there's like no time pressure. So it's scratching the same coding itch I usually get from like working on other projects, but more in a lightweight manner. So I've been really enjoying it. And the other is a book I started to read from an author and a person who's very dear to me, Brené Brown. And she wrote a book called Dare to Lead. And in general, if you don't know who Brené Brown is, I can only highly recommend to check out her work. She's actually somebody who is researching shame and also what kinds of criteria and qualities people have who are happy in their lives. And that's when she ended up at shame. And a lot of her lessons are distilled into various books she wrote. The Power of Vulnerability is a course she made, Dare to Lead, How is That Braving the Wilderness? Those are some of her books and some of her works. And they really dig into what it means to embrace some things we as humans are just wired to do as social beings and we as humans crave, and how that relates to our day-to-day work and how to lead and how to create real connections at work and create real belonging. And it's like very, very powerful stuff. And I can really only recommend to look at her work. And Dare to Lead is like the book I'm reading right now from her. So yeah. Those are my two picks for the week. Mika, any picks?
Yeah, well, with picks like that, now mine feel boring. So my two picks are, so I have a library that I'd like to just showcase. The Ecto Shorts one would be one of my picks, just because I think that's a really good one. And then the second library here is actually one that I'm working on currently, and it's called Phoenix Config. And so this one is open sourced by Blitz. It doesn't have a lot of info right now, but the idea is it is actually a generator for Absinthe APIs that runs off of your Ecto models. So you basically point it at some Ecto schemas and it will generate a Absinthe API on all the code related to that for you. And then you can feel free to just edit all the code that comes out of it. And it's basically just generated. So at the end of the day, it's just Absinthe code and you can own it.
Nice. Okay. I guess we're done then. Was fun talking to you, Mika.
Yeah, you too, Sasha and Alan.
Then,
yep, thank you for coming on. I learned a lot today.
Yeah.
And I learned that umbrellas are not actually so bad.
No, they're great. I love umbrellas. I'm a big fan. They definitely can.
It, I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's probably the same as with any somewhat complex topic. It depends.
Probably. It probably does. Although I still, like, I've literally never ran it. Like, there's been one time where we ran into a circular dependency. And that was because the person that wrote the code forgot to actually include the dependency in their dependency tree, like the umbrella dependency. And because you could, like, before, I think it was 1.11 or 12 that introduced boundaries. But before that, you could just call to any app in your umbrella. Cool, yeah. And so that caused, like, cyclical issues. So once 1.11 came out, I don't think there's really that many issues that you can hit anymore outside of config. Config is, of course, the biggest issue.
Config was the one which both had, gave us the most headaches. Yeah, where we like wanted to configure a part in one way in one application and differently in another application. And that is, if that part doesn't give you an easy way to do that, then you're basically screwed.
Yeah, it's very hard.
That was a really big issue. So yeah. Okay, then thank you for visiting us. Thank you for spending this time with us. And thank you for listening, folks. And tune in next time when we have another episode of the Elixir Mix. Bye-bye.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.